Blog Talk Radio.
Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
Hey, how you doing out there? Wow. You know, it is a Saturday here in California. It's a rainy day, and I'm happy to say, even though it's miserable out, I love it. I love the weather. I love the rain. And I promised my friends and family that I would not be unhappy and raise hell about driving in soaked roads, difficult conditions, because we desperately need rain. So I don't know how the weather is where you're at, but hopefully you're sitting comfortably listening to the show today. So welcome. We've been spending quite a bit of time all over the world in the last couple of weeks. Today is a America focus. Our topic will be the Americas, North America specifically. To that end, I always suggest that people check our Facebook page, Earth Ancients Facebook, because I am constantly receiving amazing documents, amazing photographs and videos of all types of interesting topics from around the world. The most recent is a fantastic gallery from Bolivia in an ancient location called Pumapunku, and this is an area that scientists just are scratching their heads at, and it's been conservatively dated to be about 1,000 years old, but the carbon dating is from, of course, it's a C14 carbon dating, and it's from the lower areas. The problem with that dating is that if you look at the structures in this gallery, and you can see the gallery on the Facebook page, Earth Ancients Facebook, go to groups. It's a 100 photo a gallery, and the images are unique for a number of reasons. The most specific reasons is it seems like somebody had a technology at the time that was able to cut extremely dense and hard stone. Andesite is a stone that's very, very hard. And the entire area is filled with not only extremely precision cut stones, but megalithic size flooring panels. And some of the stones weigh in excess of 20, 30 tons. So this is not an easy place for scientists to deal with, because they just cannot get their heads around what technology was involved at the time to actually construct these buildings. So it's actually featured in Graham Hancock's book. There's a number of authors who discuss Pumapunku, and I suggest you take a look at it, because it's one of those artifacts, out of place artifacts that people just cannot figure out. So check that out. The other thing I want to mention is I have always posted a lot of info around the elongated head humanoids who have at one time lived on the earth. There's the great abundance of them in Paracas, Peru, but it seems, and there's been evidence, and there actually is a growing body of evidence that there were a group of humanoids that had physical structures. They were bigger than we are today. They had denser bones, and they had these elongated craniums that in the beginning people thought were head-bound, head-binding tradition. But as more and more pathologists got involved and there were dissections of these people, it turned out that they were actually a bigger head. I mean, the craniums were elongated, in some cases 25 to 30% bigger and longer in brain capacity than we are today. And I posted one of these individuals with a photograph. The image is of Nefertiti's famous bust in Egypt. And if you look at her head from a profile, it seems like it's extremely, extremely long. And somebody sent me a photograph of one of these Paracas skulls superimposed onto Nefertiti's head. And what's unique about this is that it is almost a perfect fit for her. Now, we've never found Nefertiti's skeleton. We don't know if it was destroyed, if it was moved, or if it was put into a burial area which was unmarked and we just didn't know about it. But we do have the artist's renderings of her daughters, and both of her daughters are beautifully rendered, and they have significantly long heads, very long, unusually flattened, elongated heads. And so stands to reason that she could have been from a race of humans that once walked the earth, and she, Nefertiti and her offspring were perhaps the last of a ruling race. We don't know. It's easier said. It's kind of fantastic to even consider, but when you see this image, it's striking. It's quite striking, and you can see it on the Facebook page, Earth Ancients group. It's there, and it's really, again, brought up a lot of controversy. So check that out. That's on the world side. So let's talk a little bit about what's happening on the North American side. And as you know, I brought up the amazing discovery of Roman artifacts on Oak Island in Nova Scotia, just above the United States. And we had Hutton Pulitzer on, and he's told us a few things about the discovery, but I'm bringing him on right now to tell us a little more about some of the latest revelations involving the Canadian government. So, Hutton, what can you tell us about some of the newest research on this discovery?
Hey, Cliff. Thanks for having me. Actually, it's very interesting. I could state clearly it's going better than we ever could have imagined. You know, when you put out new research and you put out new information, you hope that it catch on and people start reading it. But this is going even bigger than we expected. Let me give you a for instance. You know, anytime a discovery comes out that challenges the orthodoxy or challenges the elitist when it comes to history, it's always going to be challenged. But this one seems to open the Watergate to gates to people that have found stuff out in the water, and it is just flowing in faster than possible. But the most important breakthrough is the Canadian government is now saying, wait a minute. If this sword really exists, we haven't seen it, and we want to take a look at it and do additional testing on it. And I think that's a major breakthrough to get the attention of the government saying, wait, we haven't even seen it yet. We want to see it, and we want to test it.
What does it mean when the government says they would like to see it? Does that mean that they have a group of scientists that would look at it, or they just want to see if it's actually what was been reported?
Well, I find it interesting. The treasure trove license is required to surrender these things over to the Canadian government. And, of course, the sword itself was brought forth to the island on August 20th, 2014. So it's been quite a while. I'm surprised they don't actually have it. What they want to do is they want to do their own testing. And what I found absolutely brilliant is the head of cultural ministries made a statement and said, look, regular people just can't look at this, or somebody here local just can't eyeball it and say, hey, this is what it is. We need bona fide Roman experts to look at it. And more importantly, we need to do the type of testing that can truly verify what it is. And I think what they realize is you can't just maybe go to a local community college in Halifax near the island, or if they have one academic that's done a few Roman things or worked in Rome and just eyeball this thing, or you can't just look at it with basic lab equipment, because, you know, some people think you can judge the patina. In some cases you can. But what this particular sword requires to be properly identified is it requires that XRF technology like we did and bigger labs that actually use radio waves, you know, radioactive waves actually, to excite the molecules, the atoms down in the sword. And so they can look at that unique signature, because it's in that signature that you can tell where it comes from. Let me give you an example. In the past, somebody would take this sword and they'd run up to the local college that's the closest by and see if there's an archaeology or anthropology guy. And a good home run would be, hey, has this guy ever done any work in Rome or Italy or any Italian projects? And they'll hand it to him and he'll kind of, you know, look at it with maybe a ceramics tester or whatever to look at the patina, and you'll say, oh, wow, this is old. But they're constrained within the United States system that he would only be able to say maybe the 18th century, which means it came into being sometime in the 1700s, because that's what their sailing culture determines when everything happened there. So they're going to be constrained by their sailing culture. And I think the Minister of Cultures there in Canada recognized this sword needs to be shipped out of Canada and Nova Scotia, probably needs to go to the British Museum, or it needs to go to certain museums over in Rome. And they need to do two things. They also need to do the XRF testing like we did to see the intricate internal contents of the sword. But they need somebody who's handled and seen these things head to head. So it's not just based on an eyeball and an opinion. It's based on hard science and internal data to the metal. Because now it's not just knowing that the metal is bronze, or even known that the metal is an ancient copper alloy. They now have done so much work internationally that based on the metals inside, they can now pinpoint it down like looking at a fingerprint to the ancient Roman mine it came from.
Okay, so we saw pictures of the sword on someone's car hood or something, and so that was taken, what? How long ago was that taken? So no one's seen the sword since, or what?
Well, it has been seen since, because they showed it on last week's episode of Curse of Oak Island, and they finally brought it forward. Of course, okay. That's a 2016 event. The photo you saw on the hood, that is the day that I did my archaeological photo documentation of the sword, measuring, weighing, etc. The photos you see of the sword laying on a newspaper, I did that on purpose, because I'm standing in Dan Blankenship's house, and right next to the handle on the sword, you can see it's obviously dated August 20th, 2014. I knew there was a potential that people wouldn't want to talk to it. The one on the hood is where I asked Marty to put his hand down next to it, because you can see his reflection in the hood. So that was August 20th, 2014. It took
And where has it been since? Where is it now?
Well, it's been in the hands of Rick Lagina and Marty Lagina, the stars of the show and the partners and owners with Dan Blankenship on the island. They've held on to it since then. See, there was some question about were they even going to talk about it, because television doesn't necessarily like to give answers. And if it goes too much Roman, they're afraid they're going to lose Templar audience or Spanish Treasure audience, et cetera.
Okay.
So there was,
right.
Like, remember, television thrives off of building a mass audience. And television is so systematic that if there was a way to work in Bigfoot hunters on the island, they'd work in Bigfoot hunters in hopes it would reach more audience numbers. That's the way TV works. So TV entertainment sometimes doesn't match to history discovery, because if they show too much of the Roman stuff we showed, and they show too many of the Roman symbols, and they show too much of what's real with this sword, then what happens is they're afraid they're going to lose the Templar viewers, the Spanish treasure viewers, the ancient alien viewers, or whatever. And so that's how the TV game is played. But that sword should have already been turned over. It hasn't. But I'm hoping, here's what the key is, I'm hoping it actually ends up in Naples. And the reason in Naples is because one of the sister swords that we use to confirm the authenticity of this sword is actually housed in the Naples Museum as one of their most prized artifacts. And we're hoping we get a head-to-head test to prove that this is, in fact, one of the multiple long-lost sisters.
Now, you mentioned that before, that it's a part of a very rare ceremonial sword. It's not usually a battle sword. It's more of an icon or a medal-like item. Did you actually pick up this sword in your hand? Does it feel like a weighted sword? Is it, like, heavy?
Yes. It's absolutely
so it feels like
perfect.
Something that was actually made as a – so you're pretty convinced that it's not a fake. It's the real thing.
Well, first off, like, you know, people talk about fakes that they see on eBay, and, you know, one's a synthetic stone and one's cast iron. Well, look at the weight of the thing. The weight, it actually weighs 2.3 pounds. This particular sword weighs 8 pounds. More importantly – is aside the gold, the platinum, and all the precious metals that are in it, you're not going to put gold in a fake sword. This thing is so perfectly balanced that, the number one test you do is you put your finger over the tang and you set it out, and will that sword absolutely balance? Even though it's a ceremonial sword, it's made to precise combat features. And this thing not only balances right on your finger exactly the way it's supposed to be, meaning the front half is balanced perfectly with the back, the front three quarters of it, the blade, is balanced perfectly with that quarter back of it that's the handle. But this thing, you don't even have to really, it changes your musculature. Here's the only way I can say it. If you put it in your hand, you had a gladius, it's kind of a stabbing forward sword. You're just kind of stabbing forward. It's not a hacking sword. It's a stabbing sword. This thing in your hand, when you start your hand forward, it's almost like it takes over and it just glides as smooth as possible and just thrust out.
That's
putting
cool.
this thing in your hand. But, yeah, no, I mean, it just takes over because it's so well-balanced. So when you start that forward momentum, that thing just jabs straight forward. And in my hand, it was like going back into time, and you could literally imagine you're in combat, and it just pierces right through somebody. It's the most amazing piece of mathematics and science and architecture in a device known that they had to live and die by the sword back then. This thing is brilliant, and when you put it in your hand, there is absolutely no doubt, oh, my God, this is a powerful, powerful item.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to post another picture of it on our Facebook page, and I think you had a short, brief article that the Canadian government was about to take a closer look at it. And if you're right, if they do involve some Roman experts from Rome, Italy, there would be, you know, conclusive evidence, because they have probably the biggest collection in the world. That's where the Romans were. So, fantastic
wants answers,
news.
If the government wants answers, they will send it to Roman experts abroad. If the government don't want answers, and just kind of wants to put a cap on it, they'll leave it right there with the community college and move on.
I like that about the Canadian government. They're like, okay, you say there's a Roman sword here. You say there's other artifacts. Wow. Are you going to send them anything else, or is it just the sword of their great interest? Because you have these other artifacts, right?
We have reached out to the Minister of Culture. We're trying to put together a group meet as we speak. We're willing to go ahead and show them all the other artifacts and talk about them. If they don't want to take a meeting right now and they kind of want to let this play out, we'll let it play out. But all I can tell you now, because we have to do this very structured, is if you think the sword rocked your world, there are other things that will rock your world bigger than just this sword that will come forward.
Okay. What are you going to hint on now? You have some a chest plate of a Roman soldier? Do you have some...
if you had a bronze sword, what is likely going with it?
A bronze sword, I would think the armaments that, that a soldier would wear or something, right?
Well, let me just ask it this way. If we could bring forth another sword, would you be stunned? Yes. If we could bring forth a big bronze shield, would you flip? Of course they would flip. There's more in the hopper. This is scheduled to do right, and we have to be patient, and we have to let them fight each one and wear them out so we can get to the truth.
Okay, Hutton, thank you for joining us this morning. It's been an eye-opener, as always. I'm looking forward to seeing what the ministry comes up with and verifying that. Of course, if it's verified by a government, that even locks it in a little more so historically, and maybe the scientific world will be a little more forthright in saying, well, yeah, we have something here we need to reconsider. And it just kind of turns things around a little more. So we'll have you on again. Keep up to date and look forward to hearing more and continued success on your unveiling of this fantastic piece of history.
Yes, sir. Thank you so very much for having us again.
Okay. So that was Hutton Pulitzer, and this sword is fascinating. I don't know. I've always been fascinated in the Romans, and it's a fantastic culture. And for them to be discovered this far out, North America, perhaps I mentioned before that there's been Roman coins found in the Americas, in the different states of the Eastern Seaboard. But this is significant. This is an actual sword. Boy, I'd love to see a helmet or a shield or a breastplate or some armaments that go with it. That would really kind of close the deal for me. But I think a great sword is a good start. So stay tuned. We'll be bringing up some more information about that as Hutton brings it and as we hear about it. You can go to Facebook, Earth Ancients group, and I'll have some newer photos plus maybe an article that Hutton has posted. So we've talked about ancient America quite a bit. We've had individuals on who have spoken of evidence of European migration, the Minoans, now the Romans, and it appears that the place known as America, North America, was known by ancient cultures for a long time. And the guests today are going to present to us some pretty startling information on the founding fathers of America. And this was recorded yesterday. We had to record it because one of the authors lives in England and was not able to join us live. So I'm going to go ahead and start this interview. The title of this book is America, Nation of the Goddess, the Venus Family, and the Founding of the United States. And the guests today are Alan Butler and Janet Walter. I'll come back after the interview, and we can talk a little bit more about what's been going on. So my guests today have written a fascinating book on America. And most of you have been listening. Those of you who have been with us for at least a year know that I have covered quite a bit on the ancient America, that being mounds, the Templar Knights, giants of all sizes and locations, and most recently the discovery of a Roman sword in Nova Scotia. Now we're going to bring Hutton Pulitzer on again sometime in the near future to get an update. We know now that the Canadian government has decided to look into claims of Roman artifacts in North America, but he's shaking things up pretty good. The sword is being validated by some groups, and other scientists have decided that it can't possibly have happened. So, but our group, our talk today is on America, and the title of this book we're going to talk about is America, Nation of the Goddess, and my guests today are Alan Butler and Janet Walter. Now, Alan is a writer, researcher, and recognized expert in ancient cosmology and astronomy, with many books to his credit, including Harem Key Visited, Civilization One, City of the Goddess. He's coming to us today from Yorkshire, England. Welcome, Alan. Great to have you.
Hi, Cliff. It's great to be with you.
And also, his co-author is Janet Walter, who is a writer, historical investigator, and happens to be married to Scott F. Walter, who we've had on the show. He is the host of America Unearthed. Welcome, Janet.
Thank you, Cliff.
I thoroughly enjoyed what I've read so far, and I looked at your website on this subject, and I got to tell you guys, you've done some amazing research. I've always thought that America was a sacred place. The founding fathers came to North America, a place called, you know, America, and founded it under with some deep goals in mind. But this book breaks that completely open and begins to look at a whole different point of view that's quite ancient. What was the motivation, Alan, for writing this book? And then we'll hear from Janet, too. But, Alan, why don't you tell us a little bit about the motivation?
Well, for some years, I've been working with Scott on all sorts of information. And by way of Scott and by way of coming over to the States, I got to know Janet as well. Janet became a friend. And Janet and I would converse on email when she was helping Scott with his research or something of her own. And what really started us out was a single word, and that word was the word Grange. I've always been really, really fascinated with a group of monks that were formed in the 12th century called the Cistercians. The Cistercians were quite unique as monks at that time because instead of begging money from other people, they made their own money. They were essentially farmers, especially sheep farmers. They behaved very differently than a lot of other monks. They had outlying farms away from the Mother Abbey, mm-hmm. and those farms were called granges. And in a conversation with Janet, the word grange came up, and she can tell you why it was significant at your side of the pond.
Well, that's right. You were talking about Newgrange in Ireland, which is a passage tomb that the Cistercian monks were digging around in, and the passage tomb was 5,000 years old. And when you told me about that, the word grange rang a bell with me because it's an organization here in the United States for farmers. Mm-hmm. And it was something that as a little kid I read in the Laura Ingalls Wilder books about Pa being part of the Grange. And I guess I would think of it sort of as a farmers union type of situation, but it goes much deeper than that. And it was started by a committee of people under the guise of Freemasonry because it was right after the Civil War. And the North and the South needed to unite again. And one of the ways to do that was to bring, you know, the families together, and they did that through working with the Freemasons initially to mm-hmm. gain their trust, and they started this new order called the National Grange, the Patrons of Husbandry.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so was it that trigger, the Granges being originating from Europe and then coming to America? There was something unique about that organization and the foundation of the organization that triggered your interest, and then
exactly.
I guess it kept snowballing to the point where you guys are thinking, we got something here, huh? Is that what the...
Yeah. There's a little bit of extra background here as well, Cliff, in that the Cistercians were unique in another way, in that they had a fighting arm. They were the ones who instigated the creation of the Knights Templar. Mm-hmm. Now, you will have discussed, I think, a lot with your listeners
yes.
about the Knights mm-hmm. Templar, about the possibility of the Templars having made repeated visits to what is now the United States. And so it seemed that there were quite close connections going on here because everything that the Grange members were doing rang a bell with Janet and I in terms of a group of people who we all loosely call the Venus families.
Mm-hmm.
These are the people who we think are responsible for the evolution and creation of a free United States for very specific social, political, and spiritual reasons. And it seemed that these things were starting to tie themselves together.
Okay. So in the book, you get into the great goddess, and the goddess is very much part of not only the beginning, but the theme is carried out throughout the book. Tell us a little bit about the importance of the goddess worship and its proximity with the Grange and the Venus family. And we'll get to the Venus family in a minute. So maybe because this theme covers not only this group in Europe, and this is very, very old. We're talking thousands of years. To bring over that sacred devotion to America is a very important key to what you're trying to tell the reader. So can you tell us a little bit about what the goddess focus is and its importance?
I have on my shelf downstairs, I have a copy of a statue, which is the original of which is 20,000 years old, and it's a statue of a female, and even archaeologists say this must surely be a goddess. And mm-hmm. she is only one of hundreds and hundreds that have been found all over Europe and Central Asia. I don't think anybody doubts now that prior to the rise of the paternalistic religions, that humanity generally was committed first and foremost to a female godhead, a goddess, who was equated with the earth.
That's right. And I would say, hold on a second. Okay. I would say that that's exactly right, because Mother Earth was the one that would, every year when the seasons would change, she would bring forth the new life. And that's what people were seeing, was the change of the seasons. And so the relationship between the sun, the male deity, and the Mother Earth became something that was a very dualistic thing, where they worked together
mm-hmm.
in harmony. And that is a lot of what the ancient mystery schools were teaching, along with other aspects of astronomy and science and math. And that is a lot of what some of the Grange rituals are about, that the ancient mysteries in terms of this relationship with Mother Earth and the change of the seasons and the vegetation.
This great goddess is often called the goddess of a thousand names. And what intrigued us straight away about the Grange was that through all the rituals, and the rituals are very Freemasonic in nature, the goddess appears time and time again. What, there must be 9 or 10, Janet, different names,
right,
but all
right.
The same goddess.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
So basically what you're saying is that when the church began to express its power and begin to change society's norms, the goddess began to fade, and this pagan ritual, which was really very important because it followed the solstice, the seasons, probably had an astronomical focus, which was, you know, true earth-based energetics rather than an artificial kind of a life and time style. This goddess focus was maintained by this Venus family throughout Europe, and the founding fathers had this, I guess, as imbued in them in some way, would you say, Washington, Jefferson, and the others who began to, when they came over to America, began to put things together. Is that what you're kind of focusing on? We want to get the foundations of this before
we
come to America.
When you look at the backgrounds of some of the most famous of the founding fathers, you can see that a lot of them came from ultimately middle-ranking aristocratic families in Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to have been that it was within those kind of families that this ancient knowledge has survived. I once referred to history as looking like golden threads through the tapestry of time. You can't see the Venus families everywhere all the time. But if you take a broad sweep of history, you can see the places they turn up. The best example of that was in around about 12th century in Champagne in France, when the Knights Templar were being formed, when the First Crusade was taking place, all sorts of things happening. And you can see there that there's a kind of power underpinning what's going on. So the Venus families come and go. It seems to us, and it still seems to us, that America was a very definite effort to try and create what they could no longer create in Western Europe.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So you make, in the book, there's some very interesting statements. You describe this Venus family as upholding this goddess focus, kind of a, I don't want to call it a religion, but maybe it was. And when Europe changed and this paganistic kind of a focus ended, they were looking for a new place. And it, I guess you term it New Jerusalem. The thing that's funny, though, is you say something that's quite amazing in the book, and that is that this has been something that perhaps much earlier people, perhaps thousands of years earlier, were either exploring North America and considering it a new place, a new Jerusalem. And you give hints to this possibility that maybe the North American coast or parts of North America were known by some of the very early people of Europe. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, one of the things that we have looked into a bit is the whole copper culture, which goes back thousands of years, and they were mining, somebody here came here and was mining tons and tons and tons of copper out of the Great Lakes area. And, you know, who was that? Who was doing that? Did that fuel the Bronze Age? And Alan and I tend to think that it was Europeans, and specifically Minoans, that were coming over here and taking that copper. So that was one group that may have had some early beginnings here in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Alan, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, we have accounts from a Greek writer and philosopher of a tradition that survived in Greece of people coming to a place far away across the ocean in the west. There is specific information about how many days it takes to get from one island to another place, and eventually arriving in what almost seems certain to be the Hudson Bay area, and then out into the Great Lakes. The Minoans that Janet referred to were from Crete. They were Europe's first super civilization. The one thing that they needed more than anything else was bronze, because they were a Bronze Age culture. They were great traders and seafarers. And so they were almost certainly going to America, bringing back copper, calling in southern Britain, because that's one of the few places where you can find tin, because you also need tin if you want to make bronze. And maybe, although it's lost to us in terms of the written word now, maybe most of the rise of the Bronze Age cultures of Europe owe a great deal to the United States. And of course, just one quick thing here. People are not going to write this down. You do not kill a goose that's laying a golden egg.
Yeah.
So this information would be passed on down families and by word of mouth. So it's perhaps not surprising that we don't have any specific written information other than these accounts from the Greeks. So, yes, we think that Europeans have been there for a long, long time.
Okay. in your research, did you discover, I mean, what the founding fathers coming to America, the word must have gotten out through various explorers before they were here in America to come over here. What, I mean, was it the motivation of a new Jerusalem that made the Jefferson, Franklin, Washington, and others come over here? I mean, we know they wanted to flee from persecution. Religious persecution was the original intent. But before the Declaration of Independence was signed, penned by Jefferson, can you kind of describe the motivation? And if this Venus family was a key motivation for the majority, or was it only for those in positions of power or government to adhere to?
It seems that the people concerned are always middle-ranking individuals. They're not always the people who rise to the top of the tree. Sometimes they do, mm-hmm. as in the case with George Washington and with Thomas Jefferson. But a lot of the time, they are the shakers and movers. And those are the people who can make it possible for such things to happen. I don't think that the vast majority of people who came to try and find a new life at first in the United States would have known anything about this. But you can see, particularly in the years leading up to the Declaration of Independence, that there's a lot of maneuvering going on down below, urging people on towards an independent America, because that was the first thing that these people needed. Mm-hmm. They needed independence, and they needed this independence based on very certain facts and ideas. The first and foremost, you mentioned yourself, which is very interesting, escaping religious persecution. I think in the language of the Venus families, escaping religious persecution means escaping religion. You know, their first and foremost idea, which is written very large in the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., is that the state comes first. So although the Venus families have their own spiritual beliefs, they don't wear them on their sleeves, and they genuinely think and always have thought that religion should be a personal thing and should not be allowed to interfere in a democratic state.
Mm-hmm. And Cliff, you know, you have to remember that the people coming from Europe at that time were coming out of the feudalistic system.
Mm-hmm.
And the rights of the individual didn't exist. It was, you were under somebody else who was under somebody else who was ultimately under the king or queen of
right.
that nation.
Mm-hmm.
And they just, that was one of Jefferson's things that was paramount in his mind, was individual rights and education for all, because that was another thing that was withheld from the general population, mostly due to the influence of the church, is, you know, you keep the masses uneducated, and that leaves them powerless in many ways.
Hmm.
Those were the things that they held, that our founding fathers held in high regard.
They moved very slowly and carefully because they knew they couldn't move mountains. But wherever you get a thrust coming forward in trying to make the country even more democratic and even more fair for everybody, like, for example, the topic of slavery, like later on the rights of women, we maintain that these people are always at the forefront of pushing those ideas forward, even though in the early days they couldn't get exactly what they wanted.
Interesting. Janet, can you tell us a little bit about the Granges that were formed in America and how they influenced the development of the actual country?
Well, the Grange Order was interesting in the sense that it had to appeal to women, because, as we mentioned earlier, it was a post-Civil War effort. And so many of the men were killed or maimed that, to a large part, women were involved much more heavily than they had been in the past in farming. And that was critical because the cities of the north were growing by leaps and bounds. They were trying to get the economy jump started now that the nation was put back together. And we needed food production to increase among the farmers so that they could get the food into the cities to support these increased things such as factories coming into production. And in order to make that happen, we had to get not only get the goods to the market, which was now in place because the railroads were coming online, but we had to appeal to the farm families to make more food to support those needs. So the Grange was a great source of social interaction for farm families, and also as a practical aspect to get the information to them that they needed in how to advance their techniques in farming to increase the food production.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a strong social side to it, Janet, wasn't there?
Yes, very much so. A lot of the rituals and were like plays where they were acting out different aspects of what we talked about earlier, which were the ancient mysteries and the seasonal cycles. So that was fun.
Yeah.
And the women could join, the teenagers, and I think it was great. We actually, Alan and I, visited a Grange Hall that was one not in use anymore, but had been in the 1800s right here in Minnesota. And we just got, both of us, just got chills at the feeling of warmth and belonging that we got walking into that building, didn't we, Alan?
Oh, it was uncanny. I think the most extreme example of such a feeling that I've ever had in my life.
Hmm. Is there any form of worship there? Was there, I mean, you describe the goddess statues all over the place. Were there goddess statues or any kind of symbology in these meeting halls?
What they used to do, Cliff, was the various degrees, like the various degrees in Freemasonry, were all led by a particular play-acting character.
Hmm.
And it was always a woman, and she would always have one of the names of the ancient goddess. Sometimes they called her Flora, sometimes they called her Demeter,
mm-hmm.
all from different cultures, but all representing the same individual. So you don't see in Grange, as far as I'm aware, a great deal of iconography. That tends to have come about more in the big cities and in the towns. But what you do see is this wonderful play acting. And I think there's a really important point to be made here. We maintain that the goddess is strong in Freemasonry. But the problem is that Freemasonry started early. It started at a time when men were the important factors in society. And so in the case of Freemasonry, the goddess is very deeply hidden. You can find her if you know where to look.
Mm-hmm.
But what they were able to do with the Grange was to bring her much more to the surface. And they would sing hymns, they would say prayers. But we've noticed, Janet and I, that these hymns and prayers are never point specific towards Christianity. They're songs of worship, but there isn't a particular direction of that worship, if you see what I mean. So
okay.
They're maintaining this right to hold your own beliefs.
Mm.
But it's the presence of the women and the presence of the goddess within the actual rituals themselves, which we see as being very important.
Now, Freemasonry plays a huge part in America. The founding fathers, almost to a person, were Freemasons. Is there a connection with the Venus families and the Freemasons of America?
I would say so. I would say that they are separate, but yet they work together
mm-hmm.
at some level. I don't know if the average Freemason would see that happening. It might be in side orders or even that they can probably overlap and be in both things.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know someone who's specifically in both of those things. We don't know who they are exactly. We can guess historically just based on some of the things that took place in the history of our country. But, yeah, I would say they definitely overlap. And I think it came out of what Alan talked about earlier was the Cistercian Order, which formed the Knights Templar,
mm-hmm.
which Freemasonry came out of that as well. So,
well, it's
if I could just use an analogy mm-hmm. here, Cliff. If I wanted to become a heavyweight boxing manager, for example, and I wanted to find the guys that are going to fight for me in the future, I would go to the local boys' club where kids were already sparring up and where kids were already interested in boxing, and that's where I'd find my material. And I think this is also true of Freemasonry and the Venus families. The progress that Freemasons make and the direction that they tend to go in would lend the best of them to be possible members of the Venus families as well.
Mm-hmm. The title of the book is America, Nation of the Goddess. And I'm curious, were you able to identify any true Venus families, actual groups that were identified as Venus families that were actually in America?
Janet has some very good ideas, particularly the case of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, we did come across some examples where it seemed obvious to us that they must have been. I don't know if you read the part about what we found in Manhattan with the obelisks.
Well, I want to get to the obelisk a little bit later, but no, I didn't read anything specific. So okay. If you want to highlight, love to hear it.
Well, we think the Vanderbilt family was involved in that. And we can talk about that when we get to that part. But mm-hmm. I think they were definitely movers and shakers along some of these lines, as well as the Rockefellers, who we find consistently have been involved in some of the sites and places around the world,
mm-hmm.
and that have taken on board some of these ideas and embraced them, and in fact been part of their preservation. So,
okay.
Another good case in question is the Roosevelt family, who have shown their Venus family pedigree on many, many occasions, and of course the absolute peak of that was the behavior, attitudes, and forward movement of FDR himself.
Is there some symbology that you attribute to that? I mean, in other words, if they use a certain symbol in their buildings, or they lay a plaque down that has the goddess image in it, is that where you're tracing the potential for a Venus family, or is it more in their language?
I think it's probably more in the way they behave. They must clearly, I know what you're hinting at, they must clearly have some way of identifying each other.
Yeah.
But they've had a lot of practice over the years in keeping that fairly secret. But what you do get, once you understand what you're looking at, is an instinctive recognition that they were there, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
That's never more the case than in parts of New York, than in parts of Washington, and for all we know, many of the other great cities in the United States, if we had three lifetimes each, we couldn't look at all the leads we've got to look at.
But yeah.
We are fairly sure that they know each other and that we know where they have been.
Wow. I want to get into the States now. This book is fascinating in that it talks a great deal about sacred geometry. And I personally believe that America is a sacred place. I can't always explain that. Hallowed ground, beautiful landscapes, good temperature for the most part, and you know, we can eat pretty much anything in the world here because we grow our own food. But in the book, it discusses quite a bit about Washington's plans to lay down and create a new capital city, which was Washington, D.C. And the book you wrote gets into the sacred geometry of what they did. And to my mind, when you add a sacred design or building or a landscape that's man-made that has sacred geometry built into it, you enhance and empower that site. Can you tell us a little bit about this the design that they put into DC and why it may or may not be, I want to call it an activation point of sacred energy or whatever that makes it quite unique?
Well, I've never heard it expressed better, to be quite honest, Cliff. One of the things that we came across almost by accident in the years leading up to Janet and I getting together, particularly with a guy called Chris Knight, who I'd previously written books with, was the recognition that what they were trying to do in Washington, D.C. especially, was to recreate the megalithic landscape of the British Isles. So, for example, Washington has much in common with sites like Stonehenge. They were going back a long, long time. They were using the same linear measurements. They were using the same ingenious geometry, which predated modern geometry, in the way that they were building it. Because I think that they recognized, as you have just said, that if you make a place sacred by building it in the right way, with enough love and respect for the landscape, then it will be a special place. Do you agree, Janet?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's exactly what was going on.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So give me an example of a place, like if the capital city, and we're going to talk about the Washington Monument in a minute because it's the largest obelisk in the world. It's man-made, though. But I want you to pick a place that people know about, either the White House or one of the monuments or a landscape that was artificially enhanced that has sacred geometry that our audience can relate to.
Could I take this, Janet?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I think the one that I would hit upon as being more significant than any other is the Pentagon. It was only built in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't call it part of the original landscape of Washington, D.C., but why I think it is so significant is that it epitomizes everything about the megalithic structures of Western Europe. And by megalithic structures, I'm talking specifically about stone circles and another kind of structure, which was called a henge, which was a circular ditch and a bank.
Mm-hmm.
Our ancestors always built them to certain dimensions. Those dimensions were used in the construction of the Pentagon. So, in fact, in terms of, obviously the Pentagon is a pentagon, but if you drew a circle around that pentagon, it is exactly 2.5 times the size of the giant henges that exist in Yorkshire, in England, where I live, and 5 times the size of Stonehenge.
Hmm.
So clearly they are taking something which they really deeply important and deeply spiritual. They're enhancing it, they're making it even bigger, and they're placing it into a sacred landscape.
Hmm. So do you think the intent of the architect for the Pentagon was to follow in line with the original sacred geometry of D.C.?
We have no doubt about it at all, because it was almost entirely the brainchild of Franklin Roosevelt, himself a 33-degree Freemason and a man whose life was rich in fascination for esoteric subjects.
Okay.
He knew where he wanted it to go. It isn't just that the Pentagon is what it is, it's also where it is in terms of its relationship to other structures in Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, if we spoke from now, you know, for the next 4 hours, we couldn't explain everything that we've put in the book about this, but also on the website, and interested parties can see for themselves. It really relies on a particular measurement, which is known as the megalithic yard. It's 2.722 feet in length. And it was used in all the megalithic structures of Great Britain and is used time and time and time again all over Washington, D.C. It has been from the time that the city was planned, and it is still being used to this day.
That's amazing. Janet, do you have a building or a site that you find is unique for its sacred geometry?
Well, actually, the placement of where they chose to put the city itself, first of all, is really interesting because at that latitude, what the sun does in the solstices are at a place where they, if you were to draw lines for how far north the sun goes and how far south the sun goes at the solstice times, you would get a perfect seal of Solomon or the six-pointed star right over the city of D.C. And okay. I don't find that to be a coincidence, that it's a very interesting place that they picked latitude-wise.
Go ahead.
Oh, and there are all kinds of solar alignments around the city, including one that goes from up by the Capitol down to the Pentagon that marks the solstices.
Okay. Well, that was we're going to get into obelisks in a minute because their work with the sun is pretty interesting, and I think our audience is going to be wowed by some of the things that you found out and discovered in your research. Would you both say that the founding fathers pretty much laid out D.C. As a complete sacred site, or is it just partially sacred? And then, as they died, others would step in their shoes as the architects. And like as an example, the Lincoln Memorial is in that same general vicinity, but would you say its placement is unique and sacred in any way?
We have not found a building anywhere on the Mall, in the civic heart of Washington. We have not found a structure that doesn't conform in one way or another to these patterns. So, yes, you're right. This is a legacy that started and has continued. One of the latest structures on the Mall is the United States World War II Memorial.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely megalithic in not only where it stands, but in its size, in what it does, and it meshes so well with all the other buildings in Washington that it's quite obvious that the same sort of incentive has been present.
Okay. I'm going to ask you guys a question that you may or may not be able to answer, but in my research and in the research of a number of people on the show, the ancient Maya, and now we know that the Egyptians built their pyramids over geomagnetic fields. And some of those fields had running rivers under them, underground rivers. And we do know now that those were built purposefully to capture and to enhance those energies. Now, geomagnetic fields are telluric fields that occur in the Earth naturally. And when they bubble out, there's a researcher named John Burke who just passed away, but he actually measured the intensity that came up through these Mayan pyramids in Central America. And he also measured quite a few mounds in America, including the Serpent Mound and other mounds up and down the Mississippi Valley. Do you, either one of you, believe or have a sense that maybe some of these buildings were built in specific areas to enhance and proliferate those energies, or is it more that it's a sacred geometry that is just made to be a benefit to those who observe or pass through those buildings?
I think once again you hit the nail right on the head. When we've been filming in Washington, D.C., for example, with Scott for America on Earth, obviously when you're not physically on camera, you've got a bit of time. Janet and I spent an awful lot of time walking around Washington. And we've also taken geomagnetic measurements where it was possible to do so. But it has to be said that it wasn't done on an entirely scientific basis because we didn't have the time or the equipment to do it. But it seems to me that that what is happening there is certainly emanating from under the ground. So in addition to what Janet said about the astronomical significance of the placement of Washington, D.C., I'm sure that you're right, Cliff, and that underpinning it is something very potent.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. I'm just curious because you really brought my attention in your book of the obelisks, and to date, we don't really know why they were so important in Egypt, but when some of the better-known obelisks have been researched, and I think because our science is so limited, about the only thing they've been able to determine is, first, they were machined. Extremely high levels of machinery cut these things because they're so perfect. And number two is they seem to be cut in such a way that they were tuning instruments. They actually, if you tap them, hit them, they resonate like a drum. It's quite unique. And so let's talk about the obelisk. There seems to be, and you pointed out in your book, not only does New York have its fair share of obelisks, the most famous obelisk in America is the Washington Monument. Why do you think they built that, and what's unique about that that monument?
Well, obelisks are very important to Freemasonry, and George Washington was the most important figure probably in this country as far as Freemasons go. He was not only our first president, but very important in Freemasonry as well. And for him to have an obelisk as his memorial is very appropriate. Now, the one, of course, his memorial is not a true obelisk in the sense that it's not carved from a single piece of rock like the ones in Egypt were, but rather many stones placed atop each other to make this huge obelisk. It's, what, 555 feet tall, I think, something like that. So what's really unique about it, though, is that we discovered a bit by accident that the shadow of the Washington Monument actually points to things, but on significant days. So, of course, it touches everything around the mall, but on what day does that tip of that shadow, the very tip is what's important, touch certain monuments or places around the city? And that was fascinating.
Wow.
If you look at the most sacred part of Washington, D.C., strangely enough, is not where any building is. It's where a building isn't. South of the White House is a huge elliptical park, which is called the Ellipse. When we first started to discover the megalithic ground plan of Washington, D.C., we discovered that all of the measurements involved radiate from the very center of this this area, this ellipse. And one of the most potent of the shadows which the Washington Monument casts happens on the day of December the 21st, which is the winter solstice. That is the only day of the year when the tip of the shadow of the Washington Monument cuts into the ellipse. And when we discovered this, and of course we were elated to discover it, it became obvious to both of us immediately what was going on here. The ellipse on one level represents the Earth. It represents the womb of the Earth, the egg of the Earth. In this instance then, we're taking the Washington Monument in its phallic sense. And all ancient religions believed that on the turn of the year, when the sun got as far south as it possibly could get, the old god of the sun died and the new god of the sun was procreated. So we think that the symbolism of this, as far as Washington, D.C. is concerned, is that they are recognizing the winter solstice as being the time when the sun is imparting, sexually, if you like, with the earth, and that strength grows as the spring comes on until we get to the midsummer period. This is just one instance of what the shadow does, and this is seeing the monument in its phallic sense.
You know, it's funny because the way you're describing this, it makes it sound like for decades, for many, many, many years since the founding of our country, there must have been Freemason architects everywhere. I mean, building the Washington Monument, that was in the 1800s. So, you know, the Jefferson, Washington, and those other guys had passed, I think.
Yeah.
And so somebody imbued them with the knowledge and the need to continue with the legacy of the founding fathers in building something as accurate as you're describing. Because obviously, no one knows. I mean, you're telling me something now that it has to be a known quantity to create a huge obelisk that has a sundial effect. When the sun hits it in a certain time of year, it passes over this area called the ellipse, which, you know, is a huge open field. I mean, who knows what the initial purpose of that field would be, why it would be left open and not covered with a building or some other, you know, statue or monument. So it seems like this Freemasonry is much more prolific than we've come to know. So is that your feeling?
It's worth mentioning, Cliff, that a great deal of tinkering went on the way. For example, just as one example, the Washington Monument doesn't stand exactly where it was meant to stand. It was supposed to be at the intersection, if you drew a line down from the White House and along to the west from the Capitol, where those two lines joined, that's where the Washington Monument was supposed to go. But somebody came up with a preposterous idea that they couldn't put the monument there because the ground wasn't safe enough. So they shifted it about, I think, 100 yards or so. But when you know what you're looking at and you know the astronomy of the situation, and the solar astronomy particularly, you start to realize that only certain things will work. Only a certain size of monument will work in a certain place if you want to get the shadows to do what you want them to do. Even the mall itself has changed. It was originally designed to run due east to due west, but anyone who measures it carefully now will see that it runs 1 degree out from that, from north to, from east to west. So mm-hmm. It's slightly skewed towards the south, and all of this was done in order to make the sacred geometry work and make these monuments do what they wanted them to do.
Interesting. Would you say that some of the sacred geometry is obvious to us? I mean, obviously, to me, an obelisk has a sacredness about it just because we don't really know how it interacts with our environment yet. We're not technologically sophisticated, but I believe that they're carved for a certain purpose and may be interacting with an energetic level that we just don't understand yet because we're just not sophisticated. I think our ancestors, ancient ancestors, knew. Obviously, the Egyptians knew because they're all over the place, but is there something imbued that you can identify and talk to our audience about that you would say is a symbology that runs through America that's in the form of a, I don't know, I mean, I think the most common one would be our coins. There's symbology in our coins, the seeing eye and things like that, but would you say there's something that each state gets or has within it that kind of symbolizes sacred geometry and the founding fathers?
The very best one of all, Cliff, is the one that you would least expect because you haven't got to the end of the book yet. It isn't just a state level or a city level. It's at every level, and Janet will tell you what it is.
It's at, I couldn't hear you, Alan. You cut out a second.
Janet. I was explaining, Janet, that the very best example exists in every town, village, and city of the United States.
Oh, yes. Alan is talking about baseball diamonds.
Yes. That was my next question. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, that's funny. We're all kind of on the same wavelength here. That was my next discussion is America's favorite pastime and baseball. So go ahead and let us know about baseball diamonds.
Well, the diamond has historically always been a symbol of the goddess. And if you will, it's the birth canal. And the baseball game has so many interesting numerological meanings that are significant, such as, you know, three strikes, three outs, four balls, four, the four bases that make the diamond shape. Three times three is nine. Nine is a very significant number in Freemasonry. There's all kinds of aspects to the game that are very Masonic, and even the shape of the field itself looks similar to a square and compass, the symbol of Freemasonry. So that's just one way that it seems to be a very American thing, or it was originally, and it is all over the country. If you fly over in an airplane, as you get down to a low enough altitude as you're coming in for a landing, you can see all the baseball diamonds very obviously.
It's very clear to me from this interview, Cliff, that you will understand when I say, when a person looks at something, what they're actually looking at may not be what they think they are looking at. And we have a good friend in Canada called William Mann, who you may know about. And one of the things that he always says is, when you're looking at things like this, be very careful. It's like the skins of an onion. You might think you're looking at one thing, but if you peel off those skins, you're going to find something even more remarkable beneath it.
So baseball was invented in America, and the diamond was created to pass among bases to kind of challenge the team that hits the ball, so on and so forth. And you're actually saying that that design is a sacred design. Did you actually research, Janet, the beginnings of the development of baseball, and maybe there's a Freemason in there or somebody who's saying, well, we got to, you know, make this a diamond because it follows a sacred game in ancient Greece or something? I don't know.
No, I didn't come across that specifically, and it wasn't something that was made apparent to the public, I don't think, when the game was invented. But there have been other authors who have written articles about this. Sorry about that. Oli, hush. There have been other authors who have written about the Masonic connections to baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, but I can't recall someone specific right off the top of my head. But we're not the first people to come up with that. But it was definitely became very obvious to us that that was the case.
Okay, that's interesting.
Also, Jim, in part, baseball developed from a series of games, as you said, from all sorts of places. But one particular game in Britain, which is still played, which is called Rounders, which has similar intentions to baseball, and which has always been associated with what we would call folk rituals. It was always played at very specific times of year, for example, at May Day and at the time of the solstices. So the genesis of the game of baseball seems to have had a deep resonance with people for a very long time.
That's interesting. As you see the game today, the game of baseball, is there anything else other than the diamond that you would say kind of is built into, I don't know, goddess worship? Or, I mean, obviously taking off the hat at the beginning of the game and saluting the flag, which is representative of our country, happens with all sports. But is there something else that's unique about it? Because I find that your reference of the baseball diamond to be quite unique, and maybe you found something else that is also unique within the actual playing of the game.
Well, of course, as an Englishman, I don't feel fit to comment on that. I don't know that much about baseball. Do you know of anything, Jella?
Nothing more than just the specific numbers that I can think of off the top of my head. But, you know, there's, like I said, the one that sticks out the most for me is the 3 times 3 is 9 thing. And I guess that's not specific to the goddess, but it is specific to Freemasonry.
It is.
And also, you know, we're talking about the shape of the diamond itself. I'm not sure on a show where families are listening, whether we can go into intense detail of what the significance of the baseball diamond actually is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a sexual thing, and it goes back as far as humanity goes back. It's associated with a geometric device called the eye, which has always been associated with the procreative nature of the goddess.
Fascinating. Let's move on. We got just a few more minutes. I want to ask you a couple of questions, points that you make in the book. You mentioned that there's a huge proliferation of goddess statues in every city and major town. I hadn't noticed that. Can you give an example? And I mean, if a new city is built, and its founding fathers have, you know, certain laws and things that they adopt, is it your belief that they also adopt some kind of a statue in their meeting place that's a goddess statue or something? I mean, I'm kind of curious about that.
You know, not necessarily in every city. I mean, there are things that if Scott and I travel around quite a bit around the country, and we love to go out looking at all the different structures and symbols and the way the cities were laid out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, frequently we come across things that do make us say, ah, okay, there was some influence here. Things such as even there's some cities that put into their capital buildings, there'll be statues. You know, on top of the U.S. Capitol is the Freedom Statue, which is a goddess. And you'll often see goddesses on top of Capitol buildings in most cities. Not all of them, but it's pretty frequent to see that. So that's one thing that comes to mind.
Yeah. If I could mention one other thing, and this is extremely recent research that Janet and I are working on at the moment, just to give you one example of the kind of thing that happens. Not so far, only a few hundred meters or yards from the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., is a monument which is called the Peace Monument. I won't go into detail about what the monument is supposed to be for, but just as an example of the kind of thing we're talking about, on the west side of the monument are two goddesses, one of whom is called Grief and is crying, and the other of whom is called History and is writing in a book.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, on the east side of the monument, is a goddess who is called Peace, but really she should probably be called Summer, because she's bright and cheerful, she's surrounded by all the bounty of nature, the bounty of industry. And now, there was a time when both Janet and I would have said, oh, this is very relevant, this statue, because it's got these goddesses on it. But what we are beginning to understand is that they're put there for very specific reasons. If we take the two goddesses on the west side, for example, they're facing west, and west has always been, to all cultures, the direction of death and decay, because that's where the planets set.
Mm-hmm.
So it's appropriate to have Grief on that side, because it's the death of the year, the death of the day, the death of the person. It's equally appropriate to have the Summer goddess on the other side. She's facing east towards the dawn, which is the position of life. So it's a case of, yes, there are statues of goddesses everywhere and in all sorts of cities, but untangling specifically why they were put where they are, we are now finding the most fascinating part of our research.
Hmm, that's amazing. I'm going to ask you both, if you wouldn't mind answering this last question, and it may be obvious to you, but I'm always curious. America is the great magnet to foreigners. Third world countries, we have issues with our immigration from Central and South America coming through the borders here, and it's a big part of our political process and will probably be huge in the next presidential debates, and the next president's going to have to figure out what needs to be done so that we can identify these people that are coming to our country. But would you say that there is something that's other than America's uniqueness and its prosperity that people come to America, the drawing power? Is there a sacredness that you've discovered that maybe was set in place when the founding fathers set the country up?
I would say the number one thing that comes to mind for me is the rights of the individual are held in such high regard here.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something that is, you know, as Americans, I don't think we appreciate that as much as we probably should, because we think it's like that everywhere, and it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely is not.
Yeah, like free speech and the right to carry arms and things like that.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
And just the rights of individuals to due process if they're arrested for something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the right to worship who you will. It's there's just a lot of things about it that go back to our founding fathers that were unique to them, especially at that time period.
Hmm.
That is so true. And, you know, one would say, well, yes, that's true when it's set against nations that are still developing, but that's not the whole story. I live in, you know, one of the best known nations in the world, but my country, as much as I love it and admire it, is not the same sort of country as the United States. I do not live in a republic. You know, I don't live in a place that has a constitution of the same kind which is in the United States and which guarantees everybody their rights. And on one level, that looks like people might be going there just because of that, because of the democracy, because of the riches, because of the potential. But there's something much more, Cliff, that underpins all this. It's an instinctive knowledge about the bravest experiment that humanity has ever undertaken. I'm sure that's the ultimate answer.
Hmm. That's wonderful. Well, this book is a real fascinating piece of work. I really encourage our listeners to go out and get it. You can get it on Amazon now. The title is America, Nation of the Goddess, The Venus Families, and the Founding of the United States. And my guests today have been Alan Butler and Janet Walter. You guys, fantastic book. Much success. And do you want to give us the location of your website, which is you guys are working on it still. You're adding pages to it. What's the link?
It's www.nationofthegoddess.com.
Okay. Okay, this is fantastic. So, hey, it's been a pleasure, and much great success to you both, and I look forward to probably hearing more about this, because I think you're really onto something here. It's fascinating.
It's been wonderful to talk to an interviewer who's so knowledgeable, Cliff. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Cliff. Thank you for the opportunity. We really appreciate it.
Great. Good luck to you. So that was the interview. America, Nation of the Goddess is the title of the book, and I just touched on a few things. They give away and reveal a tremendous amount of information related to the sacred geometry. Also, why baseball is there's a sexual connotation to the design, which I thought was kind of interesting. Goes back to the goddess. And it's just, the book's filled with a lot of information on the Freemasons and what these founding fathers intended us who would live us, those of us who live in America, United States, to embrace. And a lot of these things that are a part of America, we don't even understand. We just take it for granted. So hope you enjoyed that. Okay, that's it for today's program. Stay tuned next week. And remember, we're going to be doing a crowdfunding program real soon. And we'll have some products for you to check out and have you help us develop a network of programs under the Earth Ancients banner. Have a great day.